Hey, welcome back to That 70s Card Show. I'm your host, John Keating, and I thank you for joining me as I take a look back at the cards and the culture of the very colorful 1970s. We'll revisit a more simple time in our hobby by taking a deep dive into the sets and the stats with a generous amount of dad facts sprinkled in. That 70s Card Show is currently sponsored by nobody. If you have a comment or suggestion, I urge you to reach out to me at that70scardshow@gmail.com. That 70s Card Show on YouTube or 70s Card on Twitter. So again, we, meaning me, do a podcast here and we simulcast that on YouTube just to show you that there is no tomfoolery happening here in the card cave. So episode 38, before we get to our topic at hand here, we'll talk a little bit about what's going on. Year 1972, Linda Ronstadt's backup band decided to go out on their own, formed a band called The Eagles, which ended up being the most successful American rock and roll band ever, according to record sales. They released several albums in the 70s, obviously, many albums, great albums all, I think. One thing that reminded me of what is happening in our hobby right now is the song Life in the Fast Lane sort of reminds me of the collector and the hobby as the subjects of that song. I happen to travel in the slow lane here in the vintage sector and pretty much immune to what is happening in the hobby as far as the headlines. Obviously, our hobby is going through a stress test, and hopefully we will successfully pass these tests. And my opinion on nothing in particular is I think we're in for more of the same due to the fact that several of these aspects of the hobby have not been stress tested. And I do have concerns about the way some of these things operate. So anyway, we'll see what happens there. Big week for me traveling. Started out in Vegas, back to Philadelphia, down to Washington, D.C. for a couple of days and back home this weekend. Celebrated birthday number 54 this weekend and slamming through this large collection of post-junk, early modern, I guess post-junk, early new modern. I don't know how you want to call it here. But anyway, I'm still slamming through a massive collection, which is really cool to see a lot of the cards from the mid to late 90s into the mid to late double zeros. Enjoying adding those to my collection, logging them in the Beckett, OPG, etc. Big week for baseball news. Obviously, Baseball Hall of Fame is going to be the proposed, or I guess the thought is that we're going to have some announcements this week on people that have been elected. Honestly, there's been six people elected by the various committees, and I think that it's possible that nobody gets elected by the writers this week, which is great for those six, two living and four deceased members, and their families can kind of enjoy the spotlight maybe this summer. As far as who's going to get in this week, do not know. I am one of those people that likes to look back at things and not predict things because I have no idea what's going to happen. Ray from Philly obviously does a great job with his tracking of that stuff. Mike Moynihan as well. I am a spectator here in the Baseball Hall of Fame elections. But I will tell you that I think it's time we get over the whole steroid thing. That may be controversial to say that, but throughout baseball, there have been advantages, both legal and illegal, that have given an advantage to hitters, given an advantage to pitchers, and whatnot. So I feel that steroids was not cheating. I know that sounds weird. I'm a vintage guy, but a lot of the vintage guys that I collect were hopped up on greenies, amphetamines. A little later on, the cocaine, which we call the Peruvian marching powder, and other things. You know, Mickey Mantle had modern science in his corner, repairing his knee. Mickey Mantle probably would have had another 150 home runs, might not have spent a lot of nights staring at the bottom of a liquor bottle. Who knows? Bob Gibson, Sandy Koufax, great pitchers no matter what era, but obviously had a little bit of an advantage with a taller mound. Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Ty Cobb, and a lot of people from that generation, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, got to play essentially against 25% of the best talent in the game, right? So no interleague player play, which eliminates partially that, but more importantly, they did not get to play against the most of the Hispanic and Negro League players of the time, which were just as good as they were. So if you were playing in a particular league, the American League or the National League, you were playing against 25% of the best players in the game. So anyway, my point being is let's get over, maybe get over the whole steroid thing. Mark McGwire hit a lot of home runs as a rookie, broke the record, set the record, whatnot. He hit a lot of home runs 10 years later as well. So I'm all for closing that chapter because essentially the whole game is tainted if you want to parse them their things. So apologize for the rant. And rants. This is episode 38. Like I said, 1972 Topps Football, and this is inspired by Ken Kinsley at Beans Ball Card Blog. Ken is an interesting collector who I hope to have on soon. In that he doesn't collect the same things I collect, but he does run a nice vintage football sale on Twitter Friday nights, or hosts one, I should say. And so, Ken, this is for you. And boy, what a surprise this set was. But hey, let's get on to some dad facts, okay? The year is 1972. In 1972, of course, airplanes were still falling out of the air. Countries were still in the throes of upheaval, whether they were old colonial colonies or places like Northern Ireland. Okay. And I won't go too deep into that because that, I'm kind of related to that whole situation over there in Northern Ireland. So anyway, moving on, January 5th, U.S. President Richard Nixon orders the development of the space shuttle program. Pretty cool. January 24th, Japanese soldier Soichi Yokoi is discovered in Guam. He had spent 28 years in the jungle, having failed to surrender after World War II. February 2nd, the last draft lottery is held, a watershed event in the wind down of military conscription in the United States during the Vietnam era. These draft candidates are never called to duty. In fact, later on in 72, nobody that had been drafted would be sent overseas to Vietnam, apparently, or elsewhere. February 3rd through the 13th, the 72 Winter Olympics are held in Sapporo, Japan. February 13th, Led Zeppelin's concert in Singapore is canceled when government officials will not let them off the airplane because of their long hair. I assume it was because they had threatened to play the song Four Sticks as well, which is a horrible song. February 17th, the Volkswagen Beetle sales exceed those of the Ford Model T when the 7,034th Beetle is produced. March 15th, The Godfather has its premiere at the Lowe's State Theater in New York City. April 17th, the first marathon in Boston, in which a woman is officially allowed to compete. So I'm going to read that in English. The first Boston marathon in which women are officially allowed to compete happened on April 17th. I read that in Yoda verse before. May 11th, the Boston Bruins defeat the New York Rangers 4-2 to win the Stanley Cup. May 21st, St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican City, Laszlo Toth attacks Michelangelo's Pietà statue with a geologist hammer, shouting that he is Jesus Christ. The Pietà is probably the most beautiful piece of art I have ever seen in my life, with my own two eyes carved out of one piece of marble. And even more interestingly, is it's the only piece, I think, that contains Michelangelo's actual signature. After that, he thought it was too vain to sign your own art. Pietà is now behind plexiglass inside St. Peter's Basilica. Fun fact. May 24th, the Magnavox Odyssey video game is first demoed, marking the dawn of the video game age. It goes on sale to the public in August. My Uncle Walt had one of these in his, what would be called now a man cave. Pretty cool. We played Pong. That was the highlight of our holidays, was going over to Uncle Walt's to play Pong. June 17th, the Watergate scandal. Five White House operatives are arrested for burglarizing the offices of the Democratic National Committee. Obviously, the country and probably world will be fixated on this for the next few years. September 4th, the new Price is Right is a revival of the 56 to 65 NBC and ABC game show. And that premieres on CBS alongside Gambit and The Joker's Wild, overhauling the network's daytime schedule. Remember watching that with my mother many times on Colonial Street in Philadelphia. In fact, 72 was my last year of freedom, as I would enter school prematurely a year early in September of 72, beginning a life of schooling, working. September 17th, the television series MASH begins its run on CBS. The beginning years of MASH were the best, in my opinion. October 1st, Alex Comfort's best-selling manual, The Joy of Sex, is published. October 22nd, the Oakland Athletics defeat the Cincinnati Reds 4-3 to capture Major League Baseball's World Series. It is the Athletics' first championship since 1930, when the franchise was in Philadelphia. October 25th, the first female agents are hired by the FBI. November 7th, the 1972 U.S. presidential election, Republican incumbent Richard Nixon defeats Democratic Senator George McGovern in a landslide. It has the lowest voter turnout since 1948, with only 55% of the electorate voting. I imagine we're kind of, we've been around that the last 20 years, perhaps. November 14th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closes above 1,000 for the first time. Last I looked, it was around 35K. November 29th, Atari kicks off the first generation of video games with the release of their seminal arcade version of Pong, the first game to achieve commercial success. Pong arcades, that became a way of life in the mid to late 70s for sure. Yeah, and that same day, the Tea House, Mellow Yellow, opens on the Amstel River in Amsterdam, pioneering the legal sale of cannabis in the Netherlands. December 23rd, a 6.2 on the Richter scale, Nicaraguan earthquake kills 5 to 11,000 people in the capital of Managua. President Anastasio Somoza is later accused of not distributing millions of dollars worth of foreign aid. December 26th, former U.S. President Harry S. Truman dies in Kansas City. December 31st, big day. For the first and last time, a second leap second is added to the year, making 1972 366 days and 2 seconds long, the longest year ever within the context of UTC. Speaking of that, the U.S. bans the pesticide DDT, and that takes effect on December 31st, not January 1st, but December 31st. And more importantly, December 31st, 1972, Roberto Clemente dies in a plane crash off the coast of Puerto Rico while en route to deliver aid to the Nicaraguan earthquake victims. RIP, Roberto Clemente. Unbeknownst, or I should say, we don't really have a... we don't really have a specific day that this stuff happened in 72, but a couple of these bangers happened. Worship of Norse gods is officially approved in Iceland. Burt Reynolds poses nude for the centerfold of the April edition of Cosmopolitan, and the last major epidemic of smallpox in Europe breaks out in Yugoslavia. Pi Trainer died on March 16th, Hall of Famer, member of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Of course, on April 2nd, Gil Hodges passed away in spring training. Gil Hodges obviously elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame this year. And on May 2nd, J. Edgar Hoover passed away. A guy was a bit of a jerk, if you ask most people, I imagine. Let's see here. Top grossing movie was The Godfather, $86 million. It was more than twice of what the second grossest movie of 72 was, which was The Poseidon Adventure. Deliverance that year, Cabaret, Lady Sings the Blues, and of course, Deep Throat, number 7 was at $20 million. Most of that money going into mafia pockets, I assume. Don McLean's American Pie and Harry Nilsson's Without You. Big hits on the billboards, along with Hot Butter playing the song Popcorn. Neil Young, Heart of Gold, and Moody Blues, Nights of White Satin. Those were the top five singles. Neil Young had the top-selling album of 1972 with Harvest. Not my favorite Neil Young album. I got to spend a lot of time with Neil Young over the course of a couple years. Great guy to work for. Great shows to watch night in and night out. And a true legend. All right, let's talk about the 1972 football season, and that starts with the draft. The draft held early, February 1st through 2nd, 1972, at the Essex House in New York City. Again, probably smelled like crap with the smoke and the stale beer. First selection was Walt Podolsky, a defensive end by the Buffalo Bills, and Mr. Irrelevant was Alfonso Cain, a defensive tackle, and he was selected by the Dallas Cowboys. The New Orleans Saints had 23 selections in this draft. The Washington Redskins only had 10. There were a lot of rounds, 17 rounds, 442 people selected. And this draft was a bit of a well, it sucked, because the only Hall of Famer taken in those 442 picks, even free agent signings, was Franco Harris, who was taken 13th overall by the Pittsburgh Steelers out of Penn State. And oddly enough, he was listed as a fullback back then. Top five picks again, Walt Podolsky of the Bills. He went to Notre Dame. Cincinnati Bengals picked Sherman White from Cal. Chicago Bears, Lionel Antoine from Southern Illinois. And then, you know, it's just a bunch of dudes. Nobody in particular stands out until you get to round 17, when Falcons Norm Van Brocklin stood up and yelled, "Do we want the roughest, toughest SOB in the draft?" The team then drafted 64-year-old John Wayne, though saying he was from Fort Apache State. Wayne actually played football at USC, but NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle rejected the selection. So John Wayne was denied his right to be drafted in the 17th round of the 1972 draft, but they tried. A little bit more about the NFL season in 72. On July 13th, Robert Irsay and Willard Keelan bought the Los Angeles Rams from the estate of Dan Reeves, not the Dan Reeves, but that another Dan Reeves. And transferred ownership to Carol Rosenblum in exchange for ownership of the Baltimore Colts. So Dan Reeves was an owner. I think he moved the team from Cleveburg over to L.A. in the 40s. Dan Reeves would end up being inducted in the Football Hall of Fame. So he his estate sells to Robert Irsay. Then he trades teams with Carol Rosenblum and eventually moves the Colts to Indianapolis in the 80s, right? Speaking of other scoundrels in the NFL world, William Bidwell, V. Bidwell, purchased the stock of his brother Charles Bidwell to become the sole owner of the St. Louis Cardinals. And, of course, the St. Louis Cardinals would move to Arizona in the 1980s. So a bunch of rascals there moving, shaking, buying football teams and whatnot. Referee Jack Vest, the referee of Super Bowl II, the 1969 AFL Championship game, and the 1971 AFC Championship game, was killed in a June motorcycle accident. A couple rule changes and other stuff. The inbounds lines for hash marks were moved 10.75 feet closer to the center of the field from the sidelines. Since the 1945 season, they had been 20 yards from the sideline. The hash marks are now 18.5 feet apart, which is the same width as the goalposts, cutting down on severe angles for short field goal attempts and nearly eliminating the short fields for offense. Field number markings were also standardized across the league, both in size and position. For example, prior to 72, the Oakland Raiders field numbers were inside a silver shielded and a silver shield, and the San Diego Chargers used diamonds to mark numbers. The fields for the Houston Oilers and the New Orleans Saints had field numbers closer to the sidelines than most stadiums, since they were marked with both NFL and collegiate hash marks. Yards ending in five could not be marked. In 1971, the New York The Buffalo Bills and the New York Giants were the last teams to mark yard lines every 5 yards instead of 10. A couple more rule changes. If a legal receiver goes out of bounds, either accidentally or forced out, and returns to touch or catch the pass inbounds, the penalty is a loss of down, but no penalty yardage will be assessed. If a punt or missed field goal crosses the receiver's goal line, a member of the receiving team may advance the ball into the field of play. Previously, the ball was dead with a scrimmage kick crossing the goal line, and the receivers were awarded an automatic touchback. All fouls committed by the offensive team behind the line of scrimmage will be assessed from the previous spot. That's called the line of scrimmage. Tie games previously ignored in computing of winning percentage were made equal to a half game win and a half game loss. This was the first season third down conversions were recorded as an official statistic. The Kansas City Chiefs moved their homes from the Municipal Stadium to Arrowhead Stadium at the Truman Sports Complex and became the 12th team out of 26 to play its home games on artificial turf. And some uniform changes here. Denver Broncos discontinued wearing orange pants with their white jerseys, as they had done from 68 to 71. And orange pants returned, by the way, 78 and 79. The Detroit Lions added outlines to the jersey numbers. Ooh, pretty progressive. And the Houston Oilers switched from silver to blue helmets. They also discontinued their silver pants in favor of white pants for their blue jerseys and blue pants for their white jerseys. These uniforms lasted 3 seasons. So those of us grew up in the 70s remember Let's Go Blue or Love You Blue, I guess, from the powder blue Houston Oilers. I wish the Houston Oilers had never left. No reason for that. So the Miami Dolphins reinstated their white jersey with alternating aqua and orange stripes on their sleeves, which was discontinued when Don Shula became coach. However, the style was not universally adopted, and several notable players, including Bob Greasy and Larry Zonka, continued to wear the 70-71 white jersey with plain sleeves. The Dolphins' aqua jerseys from 70-71 with plain sleeves, worn twice in 72, remain unchanged. The Washington Redskins switched from gold to burgundy helmets and from the R helmet logo, designed by Vince Lombardi, to the Native American head logo. The helmet remained unchanged, save for changing from gray face mask to gold in 1978 and modifying the logo slightly in 1982 only, until the Redskins' nickname was retired prior to the 2020 season. From 70 to 2002, there were 3 divisions in East Conference. The winners of these divisions and a 4th wildcard team based on the best non-division winner qualified for the playoffs. The tiebreaker rules were changed to start with the head-to-head competition followed by division records, common opponent records, and conference play. So 72, a big year in football, obviously. It's been unmatched. We know that in the AFC East, the Miami Dolphins went 14-0 during the regular season. Jets 7-7, Colts 5-9, Buffalo Bills 4-9-1, and the New England Patriots at 3-11. Steelers won the AFC Central 11-3 record. Cleveland Browns had a 10-4 record. Cincinnati Bengals 8-6, and the Houston Oilers a 1-13 record. In the AFC West, the Oakland Raiders finished with a 10-3-1 record, Kansas City Chiefs 8-6, Denver Broncos 5-9, and the San Diego Chargers with a 4-9-1 record. A lot of ties in that there, 72 season. More to come here. The NFC East, the Washington Redskins had an 11-3 record, the Dallas Cowboys 10-4, New York Giants 8-6, St. Louis Cardinals 4-9-1, and the Philadelphia Eagles 2-11-1. Going 0-7-1 in division, 0-10-1 in the conference. Good job, Eagles. 5-game losing streak to end the season as well. NFC Central, New England. Green Bay Packers, 10-4 record, won the division. Detroit Lions, 8-5-1. Minnesota Vikings, 7-7. Surprising, because the Vikings would be good throughout the 70s. Chicago Bears, 4-9-1. In the NFC West, San Francisco 49ers, 8-5-1. Atlanta Falcons, in the West, right? Why? 7-7, and Los Angeles Rams 6-7-1, and the New Orleans Saints continued their futility at 2-11-1. It's interesting that in football and baseball, the Atlanta teams were in the Western Division. Have no idea why. Our eventual Super Bowl champions were the Miami Dolphins. The Associated Press MVP was Larry Brown. Offensive Rookie of the Year, Franco Harris. Defensive Rookie of the Year, Willie Buchanan. I think that was a Packers cornerback. I think I remember seeing Willie Buchanan back in the late 70s at Veterans Stadium. Defensive Player of the Year was Joe Green. Joe Namath was your passing leader with a whopping 2,816 yards passing. Rushing leader was O.J. Simpson at 1,251 yards. And Harold Jackson was your receiving leader with 1,048 yards. So the playoffs themselves were known for one big thing, and that was Franco Harris's immaculate reception, which gave the Steelers their first postseason win ever. And 13-7 over the Raiders, and that was on December 23rd, the immaculate reception. I'm sure, you know, 72 deep throat, right? The subject of deep throat, the subject of Carly Simon's "You're So Vain" song, and then those mysteries have been solved. The third mystery of the 70s would be, was Franco Harris really the second offensive player to touch that ball in that sequence, which would make it an illegal play? I guess we'll find out someday, huh? So here's another note here. Prior to the 75 season, home teams in the playoffs were decided based on a yearly rotation. Had the playoffs been seeded, the divisional matchups in the AFC would not have changed, but undefeated Miami would have had home field advantage for the AFC championship game. The NFC divisional matchups would have been number 4 wild card Dallas, ineligible to play Washington, at number 2 Green Bay, and number 3 San Francisco at Washington. So Miami did not have home field advantage, even though they went 14-0 in the regular season. So the Miami beat Cleveland 20-14 in the first round. Cleveland was your wild card. Pittsburgh again beat Oakland 13-7. They were both division winners there. Three River Stadium, AFC Championship. Again, Miami beat 21-17 the Steelers to go, at that point, I guess that's 16-0, and on to the Super Bowl. Over there in the NFC, the Cowboys played at Candlestick Park against the 49ers and won 30-28. At RFK Stadium, the Green Bay Packers lost to the host Washington Redskins 16-3. Again, Cowboys wild card over there in the NFC. In the championship game, Washington hosted and annihilated the Dallas Cowboys 26-3. The Super Bowl was played at Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, which we'll find out here in a second. Miami 14, Washington 7. That is 17 victories. So speaking of that Super Bowl, Pete Rozelle announced that all Super Bowl 7 tickets were sold and that the game would be telecast in Los Angeles, the site of the game, on an experimental basis, January 3rd. Again, with this stupid blackout rule, I guess it goes back to then. That era. Why would you black the Super Bowl out in a local market of the Super Bowl, especially Los Angeles? So Miami did defeat Washington 14-7, completing their 17-0 season. First perfect record regular season and postseason mark in NFL history. That was January 14th. The NBC telecast was viewed by approximately 75 million human beings. The AFC defeated the NFC 33-28 in the Pro Bowl in Dallas, the first time since 1942 that the game was played outside of Los Angeles. Of course, people my generation will also remember the Pro Bowl eventually moving semi-permanently to Hawaii. Yeah, so that's that. That's your dad facts. That's your 1972 NFL season. And we are going to move on to this deceptively, or maybe not deceptive, but this stone cold killer of a set, the 72 Tops football set. I'm going to read a brief blurb here by Cardboard Connection. Common condition issues for the 1972 Topps football card set mostly center around printing defects, including print dots and smudges. Other issues frequently seen in the set include rough cut edges and poor centering. There are several uncorrected error cards having mostly to do with misspellings and inaccurate information. I will get to that in a little bit. And that's about that. So 72 football tops, largest football set issued up to then by Tops. Wax packs were 10 cents a pop. And you got yourself 10 cards and a stick of gum. 73, I think that they would experiment with 15 cents, 15 cards, that kind of thing, I think, because the set got a lot bigger. Cello packs, first and second series only. I have no idea what the prices were on those. Rack packs, first and second series only, 39 cents, bought you 54 cards in a rack pack. I'm going to bring up some visuals here for you. On my screen, you can see a rack pack, you can see a wax box, and you can see a wax pack. So they did sell vending cases. There were no factory sets. This would be the only time Topps would issue football in three series. You had a series 132, 131, and 88, or maybe it's 131, 132, and 88. I'm not sure, but there was a checklist that kind of bounced between two series, I believe. Again, last time the football issued in series. No league license. I'm pretty sure they had a player's license, but I don't know that for sure because it's not printed on the back of the card. Card size is 2.5 by 3.5, your standard size. And 89 rookie cards in this thing. And we know rookie cards are kind of interesting in football because they never signify the true rookie year of the player. At least back then they didn't. So that's the general facts about that. Let's get to the front of the cards here. Several different things going on here. Front of the card, obviously, we had a player's name. On the bottom, we had the team name across the top. Now, there's a white border, and there's an inner border, and then there's a black line that separates the inner border from the photograph of the player. So that the colors of the represented on the cards are the Cowboys colors have followed the same theme for all Cowboys players, but of course they don't really represent the colors of the team themselves, but they are consistent with players on that team. Cowboys colors here represented with a yellow Cowboys wording and red border surrounding the player's photograph. What else we got? There's some rushing leaders cards. Obviously, there's most of them have the top three. There's one that has, I think it's for the receptions, has top four because the third place was a tie. So recognition there for rushing leaders and such. Most of these pictures are posed photographs of player cards. Now, we have some pro action cards, which feature players and usually a lot of players. Like I have one pictured here with Jim Kick. I think there's three Colts trying to tackle him. And so there's a lot of players. There's other player cards. I think I count as many six or seven players in those pro action cards. But pro action cards obviously are in action photos, kind of what they did in 72 Topps Baseball with the in action set. So they try to do some of that with football as well. We have our playoff cards for the AFC and NFC playoffs, championship and Super Bowl. I believe the AFC and NFC playoff cards are all horizontal, and the Super Bowl card is a vertical or portrait style card. So here's a weird thing for you. You probably know this, right? But again, most of these cards are posed photographs, whether warm-ups or Roger Staubach, you can see is beautifully posed in his card, giving the Superman look off yonder. There are some cards that were taken possibly in-game on the sidelines, but it's not very obvious, but mostly just warm-up stuff, portraits, stuff like that. Now, two-thirds of these cards, these player cards, actually two-thirds of all the cards are portrait or vertical style. The other third is landscape or horizontal. And there is a rhyme and a reason to all that. The horizontal or landscape cards are for teams that have five or less letters in their name. The only exception to that is the Cardinals, which they shrunk down to cards. So the Jets, Rams, Bears, 49ers, Lions, cards, both Colts and Bills are all landscape. All the players are depicted in a landscape form. All the teams with more than five letters are depicted in a portrait style, which makes sense until you see the pro action cards. And the pro action cards are both horizontal and vertical. So they probably could have done the longer team names across the top like they did in the pro action cards, but I guess they decided not to. So anyway, that's that. Jets, Rams, Bears, 49ers, Lions, cards, Colts, and Bills players all depicted horizontally. All right. And there are some, interestingly enough, there's some cards featuring the All-Pro players, which I didn't have in my visual stuff here, but it's the cards kind of look like, I don't know, maybe a medal you'd see on a Russian field marshal's uniform, pretty garish and tacky, behind the Iron Curtain kind of stuff. Let's move on to the backs of the cards. And obviously a couple different cards I've shown here, the backs. So the rushing leaders card, typical, it's a predominantly green with blue highlights, the back of all these cards. Rushing leaders is blue frame, and inside of that is a green field with blue colored letters and numbers depicting your top 10 rushing leaders in the AFC. I've chosen for card number one. Test your football IQ is that's part of the back of the pro action cards. So basically a trivia question on the back there that does not necessarily pertain to the player depicted on the front. Highlights of 1971. These are the backs of the aforementioned All-Pro cards. This one that I have shown up here is Ken Houston. Again, blue frame, green field, blue font, and a blurb about the 1971 highlights of the 1971 season for that player who is an All-Pro. And your standard card backs feature a plethora of information. Again, a blue frame, player's name at the top in all caps. I have Bill Kilmer here, separated by a dot. It says quarterback Redskins on the top. The left maybe quarter of that has the vitals, which is date of birth, college, home, but not hometown. You know, I hate that. Height, weight, and then not necessarily how they were acquired or drafted, but it does list their first pro season. And below that, in a kind of a grayish field, is a cartoon with a fact about that particular player that's depicted on the front. Now moving over to the right a little bit on these cards. Top is a of the top of the right 75% of the card is a gray field, blue lettering. Another quick bio about the player. Below that are their both their year-by-year and their career records. Obviously, it's football, so the backs will vary according to players. Linemen won't get as much, won't have any stats, but they'll have a lot more stuff written about them. And the players' stats or sets of stats that are given, obviously, are specific to their position. Linebackers would have on stuff like interceptions and stuff like that. Now, on the back of the card, again, there's no nothing that tells us that this has been approved by the Players Association. It's possible and probable that it was, right? But bottom of the card says printed in USA, two asterisks, copyright Topps or TCG for Topps Chewing Gum Company. All right, moving on to some of the subsets we have here. We have conference leaders cards 1 through 7. Hey, one thing I forgot to mention about the back of that card is there is a, right there in the bio section on the left side, there is a circle with the card number in the upper right portion of the bio box. I forgot to mention that. Bam, done. Subsets, conference leaders 1 through 7, and, checklist. You have a series 1, series 2, and series 3 checklist. All-stars are in the All-Pro section, 264 through 287 of those card numbers. Postseason You have your playoffs and your Super Bowl card, 133 through 139. Again, rookie cards, 89 rookie cards on there. Pro action is broken up into three different series here. 119 through 132 gets some, 250 through 264 gets some, and 338 through 351 in Series 3. Series 3 is a reminiscent of series of 1952 Topps high numbers. Apparently, the myth is that one particular person bought a bunch of the cases when there was lack of interest from the public. So maybe we'll get into that in a minute. I don't know why I'm reading that now. So anyway, there's 91 cards depicting Hall of Famers on the 1972 Topps checklist. That's league leaders. That's base cards. That's pro action cards. And probably the postseason cards as well, and all pro cards. Let's talk about the uncorrected errors. Card number 60 is Charlie Sanders. Front says wide receiver, back says tight end. Number 66 is Herb Adderley, misspelled there. Apparently it's Adderley, and it's misspelled without the second E. 199 is Altie Taylor, misspelled as Tayer. 225, Fran Tarkington plays in the Masters each spring. I don't know what that error is all about. Lance Allworth, front says tight end, back says wide receiver. And in the card number 294 checklist, Charlie Taylor, not Altie Taylor, but Charlie Taylor, his first name is misspelled. It should be spelled Charley, not L-I-E. Card 326, Mike Curtis, text on the back states he was named Super Bowl MVP in 1972, and that was not him. That was Chuck Howley. And again, with the Charlies here, card number 334, Charlie Taylor, again, can't catch a break. It's misspelled on both sides, L-I-E. So Charlie Taylor got robbed twice on this whole thing. So this set here is deceptive, right? Because it says Beckett says this thing goes for $1,500 to $2,500 complete. It's got a total value cards of $3,814.70. Now, that doesn't quite approach some of the early 70s basketball sets from Topps, but it does blow out of the water every baseball set with an average value of $10.87 a card. Blows away all the baseball sets. Hockey-wise, I think the 79-80 Topps hockey is in that neighborhood only because of Gretzky, obviously. But considering that the it's a lot more cards than the basketball sets, it kind of holds its own there in value. So let's talk about the top five cards in that set. Roger Staubach rookie card. Card number 200 goes for $150 to $300. I'm not sure what's going on there because I think Staubach had been playing for quite a few years at that point. Card number 343 is a Joe Namath in action card. It's a $75 to $150 card. Again, that is Series 3. 291, another Series 3 card, is Steve Spurrier's rookie card. That's $50 to $100. Again, 294 checklist, Series 3, is a $50 to $80 card. And Bob Greasy, all pro card, is a $40 to $70 card. I believe all but the Staubach cards are in Series 3. Let's see here. We're going to go over the rookies now. Hey, let's talk about some rookies. So again, Staubach, $150 to $300, depending on the condition. Spurrier, again, rookie, $50 to $100. Rayfield Wright is a card number 316. That is definitely a high series, $30 to $50. Another high series, John Gillum, $50 to $30. Another high series, $329, John Nealon. Or Nylon, $15 to $30. It goes on and on and on. I think there's a lot of those cards in that set that are obviously conditioned, their price conditioned on the fact that they're in the third series. And the third series, you know, let me look up my, I'm going to look up my stuff here real quick here. So I'm going to go on my Beckett.com. Kind of talk about the third series here. So Common card in series one is $25 to $60. Series two, $30 to $75. Let's back up. Common card in series one is 25 to 60 cents. Common card in series two is 30 cents to 75 cents. So kind of the normal thing there. Then we get to the common cards in series three, which are cards 264 through 351. And those are $10 to $18 for commons, right? Reminds you a little bit of the 72 Topps baseball set again. Unlisted stars for series three are $15 to $30. So this thing, this set gets pretty expensive pretty quickly. If you want to, if you have a wrapper, it's worth $6 to $10, and series three wrapper is worth $15 to $20. So again, story goes that there was a lack of interest later on in the season, which is crazy considering the Miami Dolphins were chugging away at a perfect record. One buyer or a couple buyers pretty much bought up the entire excess inventory from Topps. And the result of that is most of these series three cards are in, you know, pack fresh condition because they weren't collected, thrown in a shoebox and gotten out and played with by young collectors at the time, like series one and series two would have been. So most of these cards were open later, maybe in later in the '70s, the '80s, perhaps. And at that point they were, their condition was taken into account and their condition was preserved. So not only will you, is it rare to find those, but the ones you do find are in impeccable condition. So you're going to pay, you're not going to buy beaters for the most part. You're not going to buy series three beaters from the 72 football, series. So, That's the summary of that. Again, a difficult set, expensive set, by far the most expensive football set in the '70s by Topps as far as main flagship issues, rivaling again those early '70s basketball sets. And of course the baseball sets from 71, 72, 70, 71, 72 obviously are equally as expensive, but have twice as many cards as well. So let's get to the judgment zone here. The good, the bad, and the ugly. So the good. So we're going to go with some landscape cards here. First off the bat here, I have decided to highlight Jim O'Brien from the Colts. He's in a horizontal card. And the reason I highlighted him is it clearly states that his position is kicker dash wide receiver. I love that stuff. I don't know where else you'd see that after 72. You'd see a player with those two positions listed on his card. Gale Sayers card, Bears 72 Topps football, is his last issue as a player. Johnny Unitas just looks great in his picture. The 72 Colts card, I believe in 73, if I'm not mistaken, he would be depicted in a San Diego Chargers uniform, and I think he had the flat top back in 73, so it's either that or Moral, but I think it might have been Johnny Unitas. But Marlon Briscoe, I have depicted, Buffalo Bills player. Again, look at him with his helmet. You know, he's got his airbrushed helmet, but more importantly, he's got a single face mask bar on that helmet, which I love for a wide receiver. And Carl Eller is depicted in that standard 70s defensive lineman mask. Looks great. Obviously, pregame warmups, but more importantly, in that picture, he's obviously at Yankee Stadium, and I think that that's a great reason to include him in the good portion of this program. Now let's get to the bad side here. The bad side, well, most of it has to do with hair. Dave Williams has a, I don't know what's going on with Dave Williams, but he's got like the Bieber haircut and lots of bangs. Probably took a pretty big bowl to cut that hair on that head. Dave Williams is a wide receiver for the Chargers and probably looks better with a helmet on. Otis Taylor looks like he's, I don't know what's going on. He looks like he's like on a green screen in a really bad 70s PBS show. He just almost looks like he's on fire. Anyway, looks like airbrush and just a bad picture of Otis Taylor, I should say. So Topps did a bad job with that. Bruce Gossett is the kicker from the 49ers, and I swear he's wearing khakis. He's got his shoulder pads on. He's got his, clearly has his uniform on, number 30, but the three wonderful white understated stripes on each sleeve. But I swear he's wearing khakis. Now, I know the Lions, or I know the 49ers wore gold pants, but he's wearing khakis. Greg Landry, quarterback. The reason this card is bad is because the Tops just didn't care how they airbrushed the NFL logo off of that football he is holding in the picture so close to his head and, more importantly, close to his heart. They probably could have used brown paint to smudge that over, but they just said, screw it, we're just going to put a big black blob right next to his ear to cover up the NFL logo, or barely cover it up, I should say. And the Rams, Lance Rentzel, looks like, again, the hair doing him no favor. I don't know whether he is in a Geico caveman commercial or he is an extra on Land of the Lost, which was a great show in the 70s. But anyway, bad cave cut you got going on there, Lance Rentzel. And let's get to the ugly drunk uncle portion of the show. So Carroll Dale, wide receiver for the Packers. Again, this is carny stuff right here. Guy, three arrows for a dollar or something. Sam Brunelli is a tackle for the Broncos. He looks like he enjoys getting his picture taken, and that's all I'm going to say about him. Fred Cox is a kicker for the Vikings. He is in drunk uncle territory for sure. That's like maybe 7 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day, and dude's had too much cream de menthe or something. Eagles have Tom McNeil, their punter, depicted, and maybe the ladies in the crowd won't consider that ugly, but he reminds me of King Joffrey from Game of Thrones, and that's definitely makes every ugly list I'll ever compose. So Tom McNeil, King Joffrey, ugly. Doug Cunningham is a running back for the 49ers, and Doug Cunningham has got the carny look. He's got the drunk uncle look, and more importantly, he's got a big old white Band-Aid on his forehead. Looks like he did a good job with his hair, but didn't really care that it was picture day and the Band-Aid stays on. So kudos to Doug Cunningham. Kudos to our drunk uncles in there and our ugly section. You guys, appreciate you. Just appreciate you being good sports, I guess. That's about it for this show. I want to thank you for joining me this week in my journey back in time. If you have a comment or suggestion, perhaps you have a set from the 70s you'd like to hear more about, please reach out to me at that70scardshow@gmail.com. Comment on the YouTube at that70scard or Twitter at 70scard, and come and get me, right? Music is by Mango Safari, which was available on iTunes and Spotify. Take it slow, right? Stay in the slow lane here, folks. This is a journey. Our collecting story is a journey. Don't let anybody push you or nudge you into the fast lane. Do what my mom did. My mom, when she couldn't get on a highway from an on-ramp, she just continued straight and got off on the off-ramp. Sometimes she'd go in circles for hours. So maybe that's what we need to do here. Take a slow puff on your L&M cigarettes, as my mom used to do, and stay in the slow lane. So thanks for joining me. Enjoy your collecting, and more importantly, enjoy your collection, and please be safe, folks.